Tonight, or this afternoon rather, we come to one of the thorniest issues of the modern world, truth. The year before many of you were born, 1989, was described as the year of the last century. It was the year of the collapse of the Soviet Union. Those of us who do remember that year, there were extraordinary images. The joyous dismantling of the Berlin Wall, flowers poking out of tank barrel guns. But for me, the great memory of that year was the extraordinary rallies in Wenceslas Square in Prague. And Václav Havel, night after night, addressed 250,000 people in what was known as the Velvet Revolution. And he compared their revolution with the Soviets, and the quick-witted Czech crowd picked up the cry, "We are not like them." But his main contrast was, the Soviet Union used lies and deception to be oppressive. But they, the revolutionaries, were people of truth. In fact, their motto was, "Truth prevails for those who live in truth." In the Soviet Union itself, of course, you had Solzhenitsyn, the one-man dissident. And the great cry of his Nobel speech later, "One word of truth outweighs the entire world." Now, what was interesting at the time is many Westerners, and all Westerners, including liberals, lauded that stand of Havel and Solzhenitsyn and many others. But in the West, we did not have a view of truth that could have made that stand. Because if you look at the Western view of truth in the last generation, at best, truth is relative. At worst, there is no such thing as truth, and what we call truth and call knowledge is really the will to power. Now, the fact is that the most common motto in all the universities of the world is "the truth shall set you free." But while that adorns the walls, it no longer animates the minds of many people in the West. Truth is highly controversial. So as with the other sessions, what I want to do is on the one hand pick up this issue of truth, and on the other hand show that how it fits in with what I've called this journey of a thinking person's quest for meaning. Now, if you were here Monday and Tuesday, we talked about a time for questions, people who become seekers because life raises questions about meaning and they set out to search for answers. Yesterday, we looked at the question of worldviews and how do you choose between so many answers, and I suggested the first great issue there is adequacy. Which worldview throws light on the human existence so that we have adequacy in terms of the answers it gives. But if you move along, a time for questions, a time for answers, the third great phase of the search is a time for evidences. As many of you said in the questions, it could be that a worldview, a philosophy of life, provides, as someone put it, nice and comforting answers, but it could be illusion. And that's right. The third great issue is it true? Adequacy is very important. Illumination is very important, but only if it leads to the assurance and conviction of truth. But of course, truth itself is highly controversial today. So let me, in the short time we have, set up a whole series of issues, far too brief, but you're well capable of picking it up in the discussion and of thinking it through by yourself afterwards and with your friends. First, appreciate the two grand sources of our crisis of truth. On the one hand, we have the influence of postmodernism. Nietzsche, who's behind so much of this, undermined truth in two ways. One was what he called perspectivism. There are many eyes, so there are many truths. There is no truth. Everything is relative. His other way of undermining was what he called through the genealogy of morals. We make highfalutin claims to ideals and ethical standards and so on. But if you trace back the family tree, go back through the ancestry of all our ideas, and what do you find at their core? Resentment. Resentment. The herd resents the hero. And so on. So they think of all these highfalutin things like pity or truth or whatever in order to use them as power. And behind everything is the will to power. And you can see that that radical postmodern understanding completely undermines any notion of solid truth. On the other side, you have the extremes of the discipline that's called the sociology of knowledge. That was actually the discipline that I followed. And there are highly responsible thinkers in the sociology of knowledge. But some of the extremists go like this. The history of ideas works from ideas, thinkers, to their thoughts, to the impact on the streets. How ideas wash down in the rain. Sociology of knowledge does the opposite. It says, what do people think about? What passes for knowledge? And how is that shaped by the life context in which they live? Now, responsible sociologists of knowledge say, well, that is what passes for knowledge. We can't say as social scientists whether or not it's true. We pass that issue, truth, to the philosophers. But the more irresponsible sociologists of knowledge say, yes, you can see how things are socially constructed. In fact, there is no such thing as truth, and everything is socially constructed. And so from that side, too, you get a radical relativism that undermines truth. Second thing to think through is keeping a longer-term perspective on the whole crisis of truth. On the one hand, it's very obvious that ages of skepticism recur, but never last. Take the sophists, or take David Hume, or whatever. The simple fact is they don't last, because humans can't live with complete skepticism. And even those thinkers themselves didn't live with complete skepticism. And as you look back, you can see the periods of skepticism follow from inflated periods of confidence in what people should not have been confident in. So, our current skepticism grows out of an undue rationalism. People tried to find certainty through reason alone, without God, etc., etc. It failed. People tried to find certainty through the senses alone, empiricism, and it failed. And time after time, when they put their weight in theories of certainty that couldn't hold them up, they collapsed and they led to periods of skepticism, but those periods in turn didn't last. Because the simple fact is, nobody lives without truth at some point. Nobody can. If you think for a minute, despite all the talk of there being no truth, think of the things in our lives that assume truth. Many of you here are scientists. Without peer review and without certain views of the universe, your entire scientific endeavor would collapse. Or take something much closer to everyday life. Take our newspapers. If there's no difference in truth and lies, the whole point of journalism collapses. And you can see when that goes, how many newspapers have got deeply in trouble with concocted stories, and so on. Or you could take something like business. I would never have believed how many books there are now about trust in business. Sounds very abstract and very simple, but we realize now that capitalism and business at large cannot survive without certain levels of trust, and all the laws, all the compliance demands in the world cannot make up for trust. We're not at a place where we any longer say, my word is my bond, but trust is very basic to all sorts of things. So, in the long run, we needn't worry. Humans need truth. So the question comes, which worldview, which philosophy of life, which faith gives us an adequate view for knowing how we can be sure of the truth which we need to live humanly anyway? Move on to a third point. We need to make no mistake that the issue of truth is absolutely crucial for faith. On the one hand, Unless the Christian faith is true, it's vulnerable to all the objections of the skeptics. And it would be another form of what Sartre called bad faith. And you know how, since Feuerbach and his notion of projection, Marx and his notion of opium, Freud and his notion of wish fulfillment, all sorts of skeptical arguments have been made against faith, right down to Richard Dawkins, the God delusion. Now, the fact is, if you take all these forms of skepticism, they can be thrown backwards and forwards at each other. If you know your history, Feuerbach was actually not original. He was taking the biblical view of idolatry. The people who trust in false gods are actually projecting, and they're what the Jews called idols. Nothings. Mere projections. Freud wasn't original, he just turned it on them and on Jews and Christians. And of course the argument goes backwards and forwards forever. We can say the same thing to Dawkins as he says to others, and so on and so on and so on, unless a faith can show that what it really believes is true. And the only answer to bad faith is the knowledge of truth that can really be looked into and checked out and become a matter of deep conviction. And that, of course, is what the Christian faith would invite people to look at. If the Christian faith were false, it would be false if every last person in the world believed it. And if the Christian faith is true, that, of course, is what people have to look into, if the Christian faith is true, it would be true if there was only one person left in the entire world who still believed it. Truth is fundamentally the issue. But not only that. For Christians, truth isn't merely a matter of philosophy. At the end of the day, it's a matter of theology, because it goes back to the very nature and character of God himself. Now, those who believe only in evolution, for example, how do you ground truth when deception is such a key part of the evolutionary process? But in the Jewish and Christian view, God himself is the true one. He speaks the truth. He acts truly. So when people come to know the truth, it actually anchors all the way back finally in God himself. And so we make no mistake. The issue of truth is absolutely crucial for faith. But of course, what we hear is people today are skeptical. So move along one more and consider some of the arguments for people who are a little casual about truth, but are still open-minded. There are two very simple reasons why truth is crucial. First, without truth, everything is a matter of power and manipulation. That, of course, is the story of Solzhenitsyn and the Soviets. One word of truth outweighs the world, and he's up against the SS-20s and missiles, all sorts of things. But truth brought it down, and his writings on the Gulag and other things. But it's equally true in personal relations. Do you know the story of Picasso? His great friend Alberto Giacometti called him a monster. He was such an egotistic, devouring man that he just burned up wives and mistresses, literally. One of them said he would rape us and then paint. When he died, and they were just obsessed with his life, five of his close people committed suicide. If you read the story, there was only one mistress who really survived him without psychological problems, Françoise Gillot. And interestingly, she says, the only way you could survive with Pablo was every single day to put on the armor of truth. And then she couldn't be manipulated. None of us likes to be manipulated. But make no mistake, unless you know the truth, and if there's no truth and everything's only power, ours is a world of brutal manipulation in which the strong will win, and the weak will always go to the wall. And that's a horrendous world. The other, more positive way of putting the importance of truth is the one that Richard brought up the first evening. Without truth, there's no freedom. Lord Acton, the great historian of freedom, pointed out, freedom is not the permission to do what you like. It's the power to do what you ought. But of course, that begs and assumes we know who we are and what we ought. Or to put it differently, when I was at Oxford, I remember having dinner with Isaiah Berlin. And he was famous for the views of freedom being negative and positive. Negative freedom is freedom from chains, freedom from oppression, freedom from bullying, freedom from, very important, but basic. Higher freedom is freedom for, freedom to be. But that assumes you know what you're here for and who you really are. In other words, freedom assumes truth. G.K. Chesterton put it very simply. If you're an animal rights liberator and you go to your local zoo and you want to liberate everything and you see in two cages, you see a tiger with a huge concrete hump strapped to its back, just lumbering around painfully. And the next cage, you see a camel and it's got great orange and black rubberized stripes painted all over it, and it too is cramped. How would you liberate them? Well, you'd liberate them both from cages because they are wild animals, not to be in zoos. But you'd liberate the camel from the stripes, not the hump. The camel, the hump, is part of the camelness of the camel. And equally, you'd liberate the tiger from the hump, not from the stripes. The stripes is part of what makes a tiger. The French philosopher Helvetius says, it's not lack of freedom for us humans not to be able to fly like eagles, because we're not eagles. But the question is, what are we? Freedom assumes truth. And the tragedy of your generation is that everyone has a negative view of freedom. Freedom from everyone else, and the government too, just the right to be let alone. But who are you? Negative freedom alone will never lead to very much. Negative freedom has to be followed by positive freedom to know who you really are. But move on again. Those arguments may be for the people who are interested and open-minded and fair-minded. What about the radical skeptic? Two arguments there. My mentor, whom I mentioned several times, Peter Berger, puts it very simply. The way to talk to a radical skeptic who says everything is relative and there's no such thing as truth is to relativize the relativizer. Relativists cheat. They're not consistent. They apply their relativism to everybody else, not to themselves. They might, for instance, apply it to the New Testament, but not to their thinking today. They cheat. They're inconsistent. And when they're pushed to be true to what it is they believe, you always hit a point at which they don't like it, and they rethink. I mentioned the other day A.J. Ayer and his rueful admission that every debunker should be forced to wield the sword of his own skepticism over his own cherished ideas in public. And that's where A.J. Ayer failed. And all relativists fail. No one can live with total relativism. So your friends who are very fancy skeptics, just push them to be relative everywhere. And you'll see where they come up short, and something is not relative to them, and they're cheating. The more positive approach is what Berger calls, and I used the example the first day on Monday, point people to the signals of transcendence. Everybody has experiences within their lives which go off like signals and bleep and bleep and bleep and point beyond what it is they believe. I mentioned G.K. Chesterton, you remember, stopped in his tracks by a dandelion. We'll come back to him. I could have mentioned another famous one, Cambridge and Oxford, C.S. Lewis. Lewis was an Ulster atheist for much of his adult life. I'm from the south of Ireland. We consider the Ulstermen rather stubborn lot. But we'll leave that aside. They can be very ornery. But Lewis was a tough-minded, robust atheist. But do you know what it was that cracked his atheism? Experiences he described as being surprised by joy. He had these experiences. There weren't happiness. happiness depends on circumstances. No, joy. Not pleasure. Pleasure depends on the five senses. No, joy. He said they were fleeting, but they left him with an unsatisfied desire that was more desirable than any other satisfaction. And that joy went off in his heart and his mind like a signal of transcendence. And eventually he realized his atheism couldn't answer the why of that joy. And after 20 years, he became a profound seeker. And so do many people who start off skeptics like that. So you either relativize the relativizers or point them to the signals of transcendence, things in their own experience which point beyond what they say they believe. Two more steps. And this one's tough. We all have to face up to the moral challenge of truth. I don't know if any of you read Paul Johnson's book, The Intellectuals. It's just one of many studies of people who are highly educated, and the blunt fact is you'd think all educated people would prize truth. No. The fact is the higher the education, the more brilliant the mind, often the slipperier the rationalizations. In other words, humans are not only truth seekers, we are also, let's be honest, truth twisters. And there's two ways you can always handle truth. We can try and make the truth conform to our desires a reality, or make our desires conform to the truth of reality. I say, what do I mean? Well, take an Oxford example. Aldous Huxley. If you read Huxley's Ends and Means, where he describes his intellectual journey, Huxley admits quite openly, he left Oxford, he wanted to be free. And back in the 1930s, free sexually. You don't have to press for that today, but he wanted to be free sexually. So he said, for us, meaninglessness was our instrument of liberation. If we could say the world had no meaning, and that was against the Jewish and Christian meaning then, if we could say the world had no meaning, we could make up our own meaning, and we were liberated from theirs, and we were free. And so he says quite openly, we decided to choose meaninglessness. Quite open. Now, many people do that without being quite as candid as Huxley was. But if you know his story, it wasn't too long before he ended up with incredible lostness. President Clinton did the same sort of thing. He literally called it compartmentalization. Parts of your life you don't like, cordon them off and put them in a compartment and pretend they're not reality. In the short run, that's appealing. We make our own world and our own reality. In the long run, reality has the last laugh, whether it's the president or Huxley. But we can always try to conform truth to our reality. The better way, much more painful in the short run, is to conform our desires to truth. Michel Foucault hated the Christian faith. He did admit there was one thing he deeply admired about it, and that was confession and facing up to where we've gone wrong. And Foucault pointed out that voluntary confession is an act of very rare daring, because we are going, when we confess, we're going on record against ourselves, which is something we very rarely ever do. But let me get to the last point. Each of you has to look at the issue of truth, and in particular the truth claims of Jesus, for yourself. Now, if I've journeyed that way myself, and I've read many stories and listened to many others, there's two broad ways people do that. Brain research shows us that some people who are right-brained tend to think intuitively in a big-picture way. I'm actually much more that way. Other people who are more left-brained, engineers, scientists, tend to think in a much more close-up, detailed, fact-by-fact sort of way. And you can see examples of both considering faith. I mentioned G.K. Chesterton. The signal that got him going and broke with his atheism and broke with his pessimism and cynicism was, as I said, the wonder of the universe. The universe was dark, but it was bright. And so Chesterton sets out to discover, is there a worldview in a philosophy of life that explains both the darkness and the light? And then, of course, he discovers that the Christian faith, the Jewish and Christian faith, because of their view of creation, you explain the wonder of existence and all the goodness of reality. But because of their view of sin and the fall and what Immanuel Kant called the crooked timber of our humanity, there's also a realistic account of the darkness. Bright and dark. Wonder and problems. And when you read Chesterton's story, when he describes how the Christian faith answers both of these and it fits, it's almost like the page shouting Eureka 100 times. His excitement, I've never seen in writing, that just leaps off the page with an excitement of what he discovers. The Christian faith can be seen to be true in this big picture way. It fits all that we see of reality around. An example of the other approach, much more detailed and close up, is C.S. Lewis. You remember his story famously. Magdalen College, Oxford, this time. And you remember the Don said to Lewis, well, Jack, read the Gospels. Jesus is a great thinker and teacher. You should read him. Lewis never had. And when he read them, he realized his fellow Dons had not read them closely. Certainly, he says, magnificent evidence of the extraordinary teaching of Jesus. Who else tells people to love their enemies, forgive without limit, and all these things? No teacher in world history comes anywhere close. But at the same time, a self-understanding and claims, direct and indirect, which, if not true, would make him what? As Lewis says famously, a liar? A lunatic? A legend created by his followers? And he looks into each of these. Is he a liar? Is the evidence he's a lunatic? Can we study the records and say they're a legend created? No, he says. And having looked at it, he says there's only one other option. He is who he says he is, Lord and God. Now, if Chesterton's conclusion filled him with incredible excitement, that cry of Eureka, Lewis says, quite frankly, he didn't like it. And he was the most reluctant convert in all England. But what took him to his knees was truth. Truth. So don't duck this one. It's about the thorniest in our world, although we'll come to one thornier tomorrow, evil and suffering. But don't duck this one. Because at the end of the day, if we had more time, you could argue that knowledge itself is personal and responsible. But far more importantly, the deepest things of knowledge are rooted in one who is a person. And Jesus of Nazareth comes and says, I am the way, the truth, and the life. An embodiment of truth. The fullest disclosure of truth. And the evidence is there for you to look at.